Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has been waging a very important part of the battle space, important service to our country, is my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, Kyle Scheidler. He is the director these days of our Homeland Security Project and a great resource on matters involving, among other things, enemies foreign and domestic, Marxists, Islamists, assorted others that are similarly intent, it seems, on taking our country down. He has written extensively on these subjects, contributed, among other things, to Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat, which he edited for the Center for Security Policy Press. It's good to have you with us, Kyle. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Frank. It's always a pleasure.
Well, it's particularly important to do so today because this, of course, is the anniversary of the so-called insurrection, Washington, D.C., 1 year ago today. Tell us what your thoughts are on the characterization of what went on there as an insurrection, Kyle.
Well, first and foremost, Frank, I think we need to be aware of the reality that absolutely no one has been charged with insurrection that day. No one has produced any evidence that any of the participants were engaged in a plan to overthrow the government of the United States or were advocating for the same. and this is despite, you know, hundreds of arrests and charges on a wide variety of things, ranging from assault on a police officer to trespass. Certainly, a lot of it was unpleasant. Some of it was violent. There were criminal acts committed, and criminal charges should be filed and should be dealt with in the way that we normally deal with these things. But one of the interesting things, Frank, is how different it has been dealt with in this case. When you compare it to the 2020 summer riots for the George Floyd protests, where charges are dropped, cases aren't made, people aren't charged, and that's in a case where you have individuals and groups who actually are publicly advocating that they intend to overthrow the government.
A so real insurrection, real, in other words.
A genuine insurrection, as expressed by none other than those who committed the acts. And so that's the distinction between the 2020 riots and this incident on January 6th. And yet you have this absolute fascination in the media with this day because it allows them to push all of their favorite bugbears.
Their narratives. If it were just the media that were doing it, I think it would be one thing, Kyle. But of course, as we've seen in the course of the day, we have had a tremendous degree of amplification of this false narrative by political figures from the president on down, and are going to see shortly before this program airs, a candlelight vigil, I think some of which will take place on the Capitol steps and perhaps others elsewhere, in which, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are going to be featured prominently, decrying what happened. And this isn't to say that there aren't things to decry. It's simply to say that it will be in the service of what seems to be, well, political warfare.
Well, I think that's exactly what it is, Frank. Let me give you an example of just how cynical some of this is. One of the events organized for today was a candlelight vigil by a group called Movement Catalyst. And that group is led by a woman named Liz Butler, who is the co-founder of Shutdown DC, which is an Antifa-linked protest group that openly spoke about their efforts to oppose Trump if he should win the election. And they held a this was prior to the election, they held a briefing and training program with professional anarchist Lisa Thithian, where she talked about how to occupy federal buildings. And so these are the people that are going to organize the candlelight vigil about how sad we should be because of the protest on January 6th. These people are professional protesters. They're professional agitators.
Professional insurrectionists, one might even say, or revolutionaries. No, I think that's absolutely right. And Kyle, the cynicism, not to say the hypocrisy, is made the worse because apart from your good self and a few of us, there's nobody holding people accountable for such duplicity, such a wanton contempt, really, for the public that they expect they're not going to remember what they previously had done or really their background more generally, let alone hold them accountable for it. And that goes back to something that you talked about earlier. Isn't it incredibly corrosive to public confidence in the rule of law in our country and therefore sort of conducive to the objective of taking down our country, taking down certainly our institutions and presumably in due course the government itself, that we're watching such disparate treatment between, well, for example, those who were involved in the so-called Summer of Love riots in 200 cities across the country, causing billions of dollars, I believe, worth of damage and some loss of life and harm to police officers and all the rest. And by contrast, the way some of the protesters or people simply attending, trespassers, as you say, have been handled in the D.C. jail at the moment and for the better part of a year now.
Yeah, I think that's right, Frank. The hypocrisy is one of the major problems with this whole issue, and it's having a tremendously negative effect on the country and the country's national security as a whole. I mean, just recently, Rasmussen Reports, a very reputable polling firm, sent out a notice that they did a poll where large percentages of the country, including about two-thirds of Republicans, almost half of independents, and 30% of Democrats polled, all agreed that the FBI was acting as Joe Biden's Gestapo.
That specific term was used in the question, Gestapo. It's unbelievable.
That's right. So you have a federal law enforcement, which is burning its credibility at a cyclical rate by its credibility for a public that has long traditionally loved the FBI. They've loved federal law enforcement. They've always trusted them. And they are destroying that trust because they are engaging in a politicized process where they aren't treating everybody the same based on their politics. When you have a Bernie Sanders supporter who shoots up congressmen on a baseball field and gets labeled a suicide by cop, and you have a violent protest where some people get arrested, and that's called an insurrection, people in America realize that you're not playing fair and you're not calling balls and strikes.
Well, and again, the it's not to suggest that there wasn't any violence, but it seems as though the vast preponderance of the people who are now being accused of wrongdoing in connection with the 6th of January 2021 were in fact guilty of going into open doors in the United States Capitol and by and large conducting themselves as though they were on a sort of private tour of the place, certainly not trying to overthrow the government or, for that matter, trying to upend a process that was underway in the Capitol at that time. Kyle, speaking of the FBI and what it's doing to its credibility, I wanted to ask you about reporting that Tucker Carlson and Darren Beatty and our Center for Security Policy, your good self, and Mike Waller, notably, Senator Ron Johnson, have been doing over these past few months to ferret out evidence that the FBI may have had an involvement in this event. Informants, even agents, apparently some of whom were handlers for people who were texting them from inside the Capitol, presumably among the leading edge of the provocateurs there. And what are we to make of that? Have I correctly characterized what we know at this point? And if so, what does it suggest?
Well, I mean, I think it's notable that the people who are actually most interested in getting to the bottom of what actually happened on January 6th and who organized the actual violence are on the right. Tucker Carlson, as you mentioned, Darren Beatty, they're asking very serious questions about some of these individual provocateurs who were spotted, in one case, explicitly calling for people to go into the Capitol the night before. And the question is, why haven't these people been arrested? There are so many people who have been charged and tracked down and exposed and arrested. And some of these individuals who appear to be playing a leading role in the actual act itself are the ones who haven't been arrested. So there's a serious question. What are these people doing here? Why haven't they been arrested? Why haven't they been charged? What is going on?
A prime example of this, I think, is this fellow Ray Epps was captured apparently on the security cameras over 2 days, the 5th as well as the 6th, repeatedly hectoring people to go into the Capitol. This is a guy who was, for a time, as I understand it, prominently featured on the list of people the FBI was looking for, and now they're not so interested in him. And neither has he been prosecuted, nor, I gather, his electronic devices seized or in any other way subjected to the kind of scrutiny, let alone prosecution, that others have.
Well, you know, Frank, Representative Thomas Massey from Kentucky asked Christopher Wray about that incident that you're referring to with Epps and about what role, if any, FBI informants played or were present at the event, and he refused to answer. Now, I don't begrudge the FBI the use of informants. In fact, they probably should have had somebody in the crowd that day. But what role were they playing? They ought to be able to answer those questions for oversight committees, and if they're not willing to do it, that makes me very concerned.
This is, again, Darren Beatty has been on our program, among other places, talking about the parallels between alleged conspiracy to kidnap the governor of Michigan, participation of some 12 FBI agents as well as informants in a conspiracy of about 26 people, as I recall, that if a similar model was applied in this instance. And by the way, as he's noted, the guy who was the FBI agent responsible for monitoring and ultimately breaking up that so-called conspiracy in Michigan was, as soon as it became public knowledge, promoted to run operations in Washington, D.C. I mean, Kyle, again, this is so corrosive of the kind of confidence that we want to have in both the rule of law and those who are responsible for enforcing it. It's hard to overstate implications of it.
It's potentially disastrous, Frank, in terms of how we as a country defend ourselves from all manner of threats, which, you know, you and I, foremost among them, agree need to be dealt with. You know, and let me give you another example. The example of the attack in Garland, Texas, where the jihadi's handler from the FBI, who has literally followed them to the event, had texted for them to, quote unquote, tear up Texas. And now, fortunately, that was dealt with by local law enforcement and security at the location. But is that another example where the FBI was allowing terrorists or suspects that they were monitoring to go as far as they pleased and maybe a little further and not doing anything about it?
Not stopping it is the key point, yeah. Hey, Kyle, before we have to break, let me ask you one other question that I put to Darren Beatty, and he said he had not researched it, and I don't know whether you've had a chance to or not or have any gut instinct on it, but what seems clear now is that there was plenty of warning that something was afoot in the run-up to the January 6th event. As you said earlier, not evidence that Donald Trump was cooking something up or that his supporters were necessarily, but that others had malevolence of some kind in mind. I heard that there had even been a report that there was a warning that there may be weapons of mass destruction involved. The question that I have is, if that information was in the hands of federal authorities, is there any chance that it wasn't shared with the Congress, specifically, of course, the Capitol Police, but presumably the leadership in Congress as well? And if that's so, and that seems to me to be a reasonable expectation, if that's so, how could it possibly be that the Capitol wasn't on high alert, that there weren't extra personnel deployed to protect the buildings of the Capitol and the office buildings of the Senate and House? And actually, as Darren describes it, there was a somewhat lessened degree of, shall we say, readiness on the part of those charged with protecting these facilities. I mean, it just doesn't add up unless there was, you know, a certain malign purpose here. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm not sure about the specifics you're describing, Frank. I know that there was an article that Newsweek published about a number of FBI units, very highly trained elite units that were deployed on January 6th in preparation for the kind of trouble you mentioned, including, you know, weapons of mass destruction or what have you. There definitely appears to have been some kind of communication breakdown or refusal by the FBI to share anything it knew or thought it knew with other elements of the government, including the Capitol Police. But it's also a question of whether the Capitol Police and the leadership of the Capitol Police, including notably the folks like Nancy Pelosi herself, what role they played in not taking the necessary action to ensure that the event was secure.
This is precisely the point, and I know we don't know the answer at the moment, but let me just close with a quick question to you, Kyle Scheidler. Do you think that the January 6th Select Committee in the House of Representatives is going to be pursuing that line of questioning?
Absolutely not. If anything, the January 6th Committee exists to ensure that Nancy Pelosi and the other people who are responsible for Capitol security never get asked any difficult questions about what they did or didn't do.
Well, it falls to us and others like Tucker Carlson and Darren Beatty and our colleagues at the Center and elsewhere to try to make sure that these questions are put and I hope answered thoughtfully and accurately because it will shed light, very importantly, I think, on the true character of this falsely depicted insurrection. And Kyle, we appreciate so much the work you do in this regard, among others. Keep it up. Come back to us again soon, if you will. Robert Charles is in the House virtually next. We'll talk with him a bit about his take on all of this and more.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to one of our regulars here, I'm proud to say, at Secure Freedom Radio. His name is Robert Charles, among other service he rendered to our country in the course of several decades, has been role of Assistant Secretary for Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs at the State Department under presidency of George W. Bush. He has been a naval intelligence officer. He's served as a congressional counsel in the White Houses of Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush. He's the author of Eagles and Evergreens and a terrific spokesman for a terrific organization, Association of Mature American Citizens. You can follow his work at amac.us. Bobby, it's good to have you back. Welcome and happy New Year to you, sir.
Thank you, Frank. It is always great to be on your show and especially on Days of Import.
Well, and this is one of them. We are marking the anniversary of the January 6th events. They have been described as an insurrection by certain officials of the United States government and lots of folks in the media who echo them. Bobby, in the course of your time at the State Department, notably, among other incarnations, you had opportunities to see insurrections and other acts of political violence up close and personal, as they say. Would you think that's an appropriate way to characterize what happened on the 6th of January a year ago today?
Frank, absolutely not. And I will tell you why. I've spent time in 50 countries. I ran programs in 90 countries. And my job during the period of Colin Powell's tenure and George W. Bush, actually, I was in the George Herbert Walker White House. But this one, you look around the world And an insurrection is a very, that word has a real meaning. It's not a political jargon word. It's real meaning. And what happens in an insurrection is people show up with automatic weapons and leave a lot of cabinet members or members of a legislative body or a president or a vice president dead. And that is the intent, and that is the planning that goes into it, and that is the way in which they're executed. And I have gone to palaces of people, met with presidents, and I see bullet holes in the windows as I go in. And I know that was a real, a bona fides insurrection. An insurrection is an intent with planning to take down an entire government. And whether you're talking Haiti, which we recently saw something like this, or we're talking Kosovo, or we're talking a country in Africa, insurrections are basically the entire government is turning over. So that was not what this was. In my view, this is just my personal assessment, knowing only what I know and looking at all the film clips and reading all the articles. My assessment is this is a bunch of hooligans that effectively got out of control. Criminals should be prosecuted. That happens. We had a lot of civil unrest, I will tell you, in 2020. And all of those rioters should have been found and prosecuted across the country as well as in that event. My own view is that this has been rewritten and rewritten again as if it's some kind of a political narrative that can be now used like a spear instead of an act of really, I'm trying to think of the right word, but basically an act of criminality that occurred with a lot of political festooning around it. At the end of the day, this is not Pearl Harbor. When I hear, it's really a disgrace to history and to an understanding of Americans of their own history. When I hear senior leadership, a president or a vice president, compare the basically out of control riot that occurred with enthusiasm on this day a year ago with Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor killed thousands of Americans. It was compared with 9/11. 9/11 killed thousands of Americans. This country was attacked head on. This particular riot, even if you want to include the worst intentions of all, we've got digital copies by the millions of everything that was in the room where votes were being counted. It isn't even vaguely possible that the government would have flipped on this. So to call this an insurrection is intentional political chicanery, in my view.
Well, it has to do with political control, I think. And it's not just, the idle practice of several people in the government are interested in even just vilifying their political opponents. This is about creating conditions under which they are prosecuted. I don't mean just the people who may have done something criminal at the Capitol that day. I'm talking about people who are described now en masse as domestic terrorists.
Well, listen,
because they are supporters of Donald Trump, for example. That's about political warfare, it seems to me, Robert Charles, well, not just a passing, intemperate remark.
Okay, so very good extension of the argument, and I will add to what you just said because I agree with you. We have a Justice Department that has decided that parents who show up at school board meetings are actually bona fides domestic terrorists under a misreading, an intentional misreading of federal law. You have a political warfare now rising in a way in this country that we have not seen since probably the 30s, maybe the McCarthy era. But what you have is the socialist ideology being trumpeted as an alternative to free markets, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of political dialogue. The word electoral integrity, which has an absolutely concrete meaning, now being banned from social media so that you can't even speak about the very violations of the rights that you have that are occurring. And by the way, I think this idea of blowing lots of air into the January 6th event in order to sort of make it or remake it into something that becomes a political spear is being done because there's going to be for the next year, there's going to be a very heavy drive to try to push through things like federal preemptive voter registration and I think what they're calling voter rights, but it's not voter rights. Basically, an attempt to take away all the state laws that have been passed in the last year, saying we want IDs, we want transparency in the electoral process. So yes, this is accountability. This is a tool. They are using the January 6th day as a tool the same way that, frankly, the Soviets used their May Day parades as a tool in order to try to twist the public mind in the direction of either adulation or condemnation and somehow therefore change the entire political dialogue.
I would use weapon rather than tool, but its purpose is clear, as you say, to affect a systemic alteration, a fundamental transformation, I think was Barack Obama's word for it. And I want to ask you, Bobby, because the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act is a specific piece of legislation that is at the moment the object of this exercise. To get it enacted, the majority leader of the Senate, Chuck Schumer, is now very directly stating he will support changing the filibuster, which I think as a practical matter means gutting this filibuster. You've worked up on Capitol Hill. You understand the process as well as anyone, Bobby, and I know have a profound commitment to our constitutional republic and the institutions that make it work and guarantee our freedoms. Talk us through what the implications would be if, well, in the first instance, the filibuster is thrown under the bus in the United States Senate. And second of all, what it would mean if you have essentially the federal government preempting the constitutional powers of the states to decide for themselves the election procedures that they apply, federal elections included.
So that's an excellent two-edged question. And let me say first, for anyone listening, you have to understand, so to eliminate the filibuster, which is what Schumer is saying he would do, is tantamount to saying, I think we're going to take due process out of the Bill of Rights, the Fifth and 14th Amendment guarantee. Why? Because this process has been around for more than 150 years, and there's a reason for it. There was a civil war. There were amendments passed afterwards. There was an understanding that, and what is the filibuster? The filibuster is a requirement that in moving forward on important legislation, there be a vote of cloture ahead of the vote. That's a procedural vote ahead of any other vote. And that vote requires 60 members of the Senate to say, yes, this is a big enough issue. We're not going to change the entire world and flip the country upside down on one vote, i.e. 51 versus 49. We're not going to do that. We're going to give the American people enough room and respect to respect that. So that's why the filibuster has been there. The filibuster, at the end of the day, what they're doing here is they're strong arming, not the Republicans, they're strong arming the Republic. And effectively what the filibuster would do, would allow them then, and the idea that Biden said, well, we should do it just once. And we'll just be a little teeny change here. We'll do it. Well, that's like saying we're just going to be a little bit pregnant. OK, and the rest of it will work itself out. No, that's not how it works. Once you've destroyed the filibuster, it's destroyed. You basically taken a body blow to the Republic in the Senate. And what's the result of that? It means that this federal preemptive legislation, it means the Build Back Better, it means everything is going to be able to be subject to a 51 vote turn, which really means in a 50-50 Senate that the vice president, they're basically, the vice president will now have power to stuff all Americans. And at the end of the day, that means this voting rights stuff, which is not voting rights. It's, again, how you've got to be smart enough to read between the lines or just read the lines. And you realize this is an attempt to gut the 10th Amendment. What's the 10th Amendment? The 10th Amendment says that everything that is not enumerated or actually spoken and given in the Constitution to the federal government still resides with the states and the people. Just read it. It's one sentence. And so what that means is, the states have passed laws now that say on the environment, on crime, but they've also passed them on electoral integrity. And they've said, we don't want to see a replay of 2020 again. There was too little transparency, too little accountability. We don't want felons voting. We don't want inter-precinct voting. We don't all, that's the right of the state. And so what the filibuster going away means, Frank, is that you're essentially shifting hard toward a more autocratic way of running this country. And that is not what our Constitution or Bill of Rights say we should be doing.
And I know that it wasn't incorporated into the Constitution, rules of the Senate initially.
It's not, Bobby.
Of the filibuster is it is one of the things that differentiates the Senate from the House. And there was a very deliberate effort made by the framers of our Constitution to ensure that the Senate would be a deliberative body in which majority or mob rule, if you will, which sometimes occurs in the House of Representatives, let's be honest, would not apply. I think it was the saucer in which the overhot cup would be cooled. This is so vital, and I think that the idea that sort of using again this instrument of political warfare to castigate the opposition, to silence them, to demean them in the Senate as well as outside it, it must be, you know, objected to in the strongest of terms. And I hope that Senator Manchin, among others, will see fit to stand by his objections to gutting the filibuster for these kinds of purposes. Bobby, let me ask you more generally about what we're witnessing at the moment in terms of the judiciary as well, another institution of our government that I know you've got a lot of experience with firsthand, having served in it, but also some very strong feelings about the importance of its independence and its integrity. Are those at risk as well as a part of this same kind of fundamental transformation agenda?
Yes, they are, Frank. And I have written recently on AMAC.us a detailed description of why I think judicial independence is truly under siege. Let me say that all of this is, I guess we would call it of a piece, and I'll call it blitzkrieg politics. The idea is you've got a few months between now and elections, which would and probably will reverse reawaken the American people's a chance to claw back the government. In the in-between time, there's this sort of blitzkrieg politics intending to, in my opinion, do as much damage as possible, and with respect to the judiciary, try as much as possible to politicize it and create from it a political institution that validates the invalid or unconstitutional acts of an aggressive socialist leaning Congress and a kind of a similar White House. So what is really happening here is there's an intent. We've had Senator Shaheen say that if the Supreme Court were to overturn Roe v. Wade or, God forbid, something else, that a quote unquote revolution will occur. We've had the majority leader of the Senate, Mr. Schumer, say that in an angry voice that if they rule the wrong way, quote unquote, they will pay. I personally hope security is very high at the Supreme Court, because I don't take lightly anything like that being said by people who seem to have the power to deliver that kind of an outcome. It's very disturbing. I clerked on the Ninth Circuit, U.S. Court of Appeals. I know what it means to be in the quiet chambers of a judge to think hard about what is the right answer. And it could be Roe v. Wade. We've got issues right now. The Second Amendment is under both attack and under potential expansion by the court. And there are at least a half a dozen others. And then on top of all of this, Frank, we have this delegitimization effort so that if these rulings come out, we're supposed to somehow not trust them because there's a 5-4 judicial conservative majority. And so as a result, the Democrats are even saying that they're willing to pack the court, that is to say, politicize the court by thrusting new members onto the court. The same way they would throw out a 150-year-old filibuster, they would throw out a 150-year-old idea that 9 members sit on the high court. So all of this is very disturbing to me because it is not the way Americans traditionally do business. We are incremental. History is made incrementally. We are judicious. We're not always, we tend to respond to crises quickly, but we don't create crises in our own world. And unfortunately, that's what the Democrats are doing.
Well, again, at the risk of sounding as though I'm contradicting you, I think I would go a step further. I think what we have in these cases, Afghanistan for sure, this energy policy, the border, the economy more generally, the inflation, we have a wrecking operation. And I think it's deliberate. I think it's underway, has been for the better part of 12 months now, and it is likely to bring us great harm. It's true for, as you say, Bobby, all of us, irrespective of political affiliations or partisan leanings. It's going to be bad for America and for all of its people. Bobby, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you for your time today, as well as your joining us for the beginning of what I hope will be a lot of conversations in the new year. For the great work you do at Association for Mature American Citizens, I know you'll keep it up. come back to us again soon. Next up, we will speak with Lance Crayon. We'll take stock of one of the closest observers of what the Chinese are doing in the propaganda business and who used to be inside it.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Lance Crayon, a man who has a unique perspective on an aspect of the Chinese Communist Party that I think gets too little attention from too many of us, even people following China closely, and that is the extent, the nature, and the impact of the Chinese Communist Party's propaganda arms and the extensive use made of them. As weapons, really, of their unrestricted warfare against the rest of us, as well as instruments of control of their own people. Lance Crayon has, among other things, worked within some of those institutions of the Chinese propaganda industry, notably China Daily and Global Times, both in China and in Los Angeles after he left China. We value his insights, and I'm anxious at a moment when there's a lot of reason to believe the Chinese are preparing for war against Taiwan, against perhaps India, who knows, against us, that their propaganda instruments, Lance, are being really weaponized to prepare the public for that possibility. I spoke with Gordon Chang earlier in the week, and he said, you know, they've really begun creating a narrative that the United States has offended China and is barbarically working to undermine it and otherwise sort of create an appetite for conflict on the part of the Chinese people. Any insights into that? Is it just sort of nationalism, or is there more going on here that suggests a very serious threat of conflict from this quarter?
Thank you for having me, Frank. Yeah, I think it goes beyond nationalism. I mean, it falls in line with what has been known as wolf warrior diplomacy. It's if there's a higher level of nationalism or a more stringent narrative that is Chinese nationalism, it's part of the wolf warrior diplomacy attitude. It's aggressive. It's very, you know, pompous and also bombastic and scary.
And to the extent that it's institutionalized as opposed to just odd journalists expressing himself, there's a fellow, for example, with whom I gather you worked by the name of Hu Xixin, who was a very prominent exponent of sort of this wolf warrior, if you will, nationalist line. Was he alone? Was he simply the most prominent and perhaps effective of these propagandists? How would you calibrate, you know, what's being done on the broader scale, as well as the role of this particular individual?
That's a great that's a great question. Okay, with Hu Xinjing, people think that he is like this lone journalist or columnist. He's not. He works for the CPC. He takes orders from them. He is not free. He's not this man who's sitting in a room and who has an idea, and then he's going to write about it and give his opinion. It's going to make Australia mad, or India, or DC. You know, he takes orders. He's specifically told what to write. So he's the front, the face of this Chinese brand of nationalism that we've been exposed to since his emergence with the Global Times English edition beginning in 2009.
And he recently left that post. I gather he's still contributing to the Daily Times.
Very much so. Very much so. He announced his retirement in December as the senior managing editor, but he's now a guest commentator. They don't have he's very famous in China, so they don't have like a number two there's not someone behind him who he was grooming to replace him. So because Global Times, like all media, is state-run media, it's a government job. When you're 61, it's forced retirement. So he's soon to turn 62, but he will still be a guest commentator, and he has been. He writes maybe one editorial a week now, but they have his name on them, by the way. In the past, they rarely had his name on them. But
speak to this larger point, if you would. This guy is a particularly prominent figure But as you say, he's doing what he's told to do. And should we interpret what he has been told to do and what others are doing, perhaps with less, panache than he, but this idea that they're sort of whipping the public into anti-American sentiment and seeking, presumably, to get their buy-in for the possibility that military action is in order. Are you seeing that from your perusal of these various outlets Chinese use to spread their party line domestically and internationally?
Absolutely. I think what we're seeing right now is a lot of muscle flexing. I don't anticipate a war with Taiwan. I mean, Taiwan, I believe China will seize Taiwan and take control of Taiwan. The Biden administration will lay down. I see that happening. What is muscle flexing is happening now. We see more attention given to the Chinese military know-how and prowess and the new toys that they've developed. But I don't think it's going to be anything more than that. I don't think it will extend beyond the media name calling. And like I said, muscle flexing. But yeah, I mean, that's where it's going, is all eyes on Taiwan. China's going to take it this year for sure. And if they can sway public opinion, not beginning from Global Times being a nucleus and then into the New York Times and Washington Post and the Guardian, that seems to be their plan. That's what I'm noticing.
Right. This is a subject of very profound concern, because I think you're right that they are going to take action. I'm hearing from some experts that it may come as soon as March, after these genocide games are over, and that it may not only be combined with action against India, but there may be, whether opportunistically or by prearrangement, piling on by allies or proxies or partners of China, from Iran to Russia to, who knows, North Korea, perhaps Pakistan. Do you see that as a distinct prospect as well?
Absolutely. And as you pointed out, this year, it was March, is very important. This is with the 2022, Xi Jinping is up for, re-election, or let's just say reapproval with the standing committee. So, his 5 years are up. Now, he needs to do something significant to secure the next 5 years of his tenure, and Taiwan is it. So, yeah, absolutely. Beginning in March, I agree with you, is when I think we'll start to see the big move for Taiwan happen.
Let me ask you about something else that has been developing of late. We've talked about it in the past, but I'd love to get an update from you. There has been a, we're told, huge runaway blockbuster success film about the Chosin Reservoir, the famous battle in which Chinese communists poured over the border with North Korea at a moment when Americans were successfully hoping to liberate the peninsula. The Chinese telling of it is rather different than the historical facts, of course, but it seems very much a rally around the flag kind of film, with the purpose being, again, to demonstrate the United States is their enemy, and war against the United States is something that is a national triumph, historically, and presumably by inference at least, would be in the future as well. What can you tell us about this film? And I want to segue from there into sort of more generally what the Chinese are doing vis-a-vis Hollywood film business.
Yeah, the battle at Lake Changjin is the name, and it's now the highest grossing film in Chinese history, in Chinese film history. And it falls into, the Wolf Warrior strategy, and pro China, celebrating, the Communist Party, and completely, I haven't seen the film yet. I've heard about it, and I've heard, it's a propaganda film. And then when you hear that a Chinese film is doing really well in China, or like in this case is, I think, the highest grossing film in China, you've got to question those numbers until you actually see it. It's like this is what China's releasing in terms of information, but I don't hear, and I haven't heard, like a lot of people actually seeing the film. I mean, I'm sure it's happening. I'm not in China now, obviously, but I doubt that's actually true. We're being told that it's the highest grossing film, and that it was the number one film. It was released in October, but I doubt that. I just don't believe anything they say. I don't believe anything that they say to begin with, and this is part of it.
You should know. You were in the business of working with them and saw firsthand these propagandistic efforts, which are, of course, often a pack of lies. Let me ask you about this question of Breitbart News had a report the other day concerning China having done now to Hollywood what it has done to so many other elements of our economy, essentially moving in, developing, partnering relationships with studios and filmmakers and the business of Hollywood, learning what they needed to know to compete effectively against it, and then moving through various ways, principally through access to the market in China, to essentially secure whatever they needed to dominate that industry, then begin inexorably crimping that access for Hollywood in China, and ultimately perhaps cutting it off altogether. Is that a fair rendering of what's going on at the moment? And to what effect, both in terms of our culture, for one thing, and the future prospects for Hollywood?
The way I see it, China controls Hollywood. China runs it. And they came in, they conquered, then they left. So they've kind of left Hollywood. I mean, they haven't left Hollywood, but Hollywood had become so reliant on the Chinese market playing in mainland theaters and then Chinese money to make films for co-productions, things like that. And that's China is the analogy I'd like to use is that they basically have both hands on the rug and they're free to pull it out from under Hollywood's feet whenever they want. That's how I see the industry now. And that extends beyond Hollywood. It's global. I mean, in terms of film distribution. So China has got such an iron grip, tight grip on Hollywood, and that it's international to where other countries have to kind of go through China to make sure it's okay if they play a certain film or what have you. So China, I mean, for lack of a better expression, China runs it. And that's what I don't think a lot of people realize.
And again, if that's so, with your personal firsthand knowledge of Chinese propaganda and, well, for want of a better term, the weaponization of it and the instruments that disseminate it, what does that mean for, as I say, our culture here in the United States?
It means the future is bleak for our culture. Our culture has been decimated. If it doesn't adhere to the Chinese narrative or something that they approve of, they can forget it. That's what it means. Look at media. Look at our newspapers. They've been gutted. I mean, newspaper institutions that I used to trust, you can't trust them anymore.
And you're talking not just about these inserts that the New York Times and Washington Post and I think Wall Street Journal and others have been running now for years. Obviously, a lucrative means of propping up an otherwise dismal business at the moment. Mm-hmm. But you're also talking, I gather, about impacting the content of reporting about China.
Absolutely, absolutely. The reporting, not just the reporting about China, but the reporting about Chinese in America. And reporting just about America, the stories and the narrative of the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York Times, LA Times, what they ignore day in and day out. It just feels like everything is being run through a Chinese filter. It's like that's their managing editor. That's who they answer to before they write a story.
Do you think that that's literally the case, or is it just that everyone is now on notice that if they offend the Chinese, anger them, they will be punished, perhaps mm-hmm. simply that those inserts will no longer appear and the money that goes with them, or perhaps punishment of their journalists in China or other retribution.
The advertorials that you're referring to, began in 2015, as early as 2008, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. We're talking about $20 million, close to $25 million spent on this advertorial since 2016. The LA Times and San Diego Union Tribune, both owned by a Chinese man, therefore the Chinese. But yeah, there would be, you know, retribution. There would be a problem, especially the LA Times, for a journalist to write something that went against the Chinese narrative. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Something based on what you just said. There have been in the past, I thought, restrictions on foreign ownership of American media operations. Has that only applied to broadcast outlets? And if so, is that still the case? Evidently.
Sure.
The LA Times and San Diego Union Tribune, two pretty important papers in the western part of the United States, are Chinese owned effectively. Obviously, it's not
owned
to them.
I shouldn't say owned by, when I say owned by China, what I mean is the man who owns them, Patrick Sun Xiang, is an American citizen. He's from China, from mainland China. But he owns the LA Times and the San Diego Union Tribune, which he bought in 2019. His daughter, with no journalism experience whatsoever, runs the newsroom of LA Times. So think about that for a moment. He comes in, buys it, and then he appoints his daughter, and she's sort of like running the narrative of the newsroom, and she's never written for a newspaper ever in her entire life.
Suggests that somebody else is probably calling the shots in that newsroom.
There you go.
And
exactly.
It's being called in from Beijing or elsewhere is an open
exactly.
question. Well, Lance, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but this is such a rich seem to mine, and I think it's vital to us as we do, among other things, our countdown to conflict exercise, trying to monitor what is heading our way and what are the indicators that we should be alive to. I think your monitoring of enemy propaganda is an important part of our analysis, and I hope that you will be coming back to us with updates with regularity and contributing to this
anytime.
More than countdown happy to conflict.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Today we'll witness one of the most brazen acts of political theater and deflection in our nation's history. Partisan Democrats from President Biden on down will weaponize the anniversary of an event at the U.S. Capitol 1 year ago not only to promote a false narrative and vilify those who challenge it. They also intend to exploit the so-called 1/6 insurrection to force through the Senate legislation that would effectively foreclose any future prospect of honest election. Insult is added to injury by the proponents' insistence on gutting the filibuster to enact the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act and, quote, save democracy, unquote. Here's the truth. There was no insurrection a year ago. The 2020 presidential election was stolen, and stripping states of their constitutional rights to set voter ID and other necessary election integrity rules will end our republic, not save it. This is Frank Gaffney.